What do you love about being outside and active?
I'm sure I've spent more time outdoors than in. That just feels like home.
Enjoy what you can do, because you never know what is around the corner.
Just being outdoors in the fresh air, it just clears my mind. Fully immersed in nature is what brings me the most joy.
Hello and welcome to the Outside and Active podcast, where this season the theme is all about running. And that continues this week as I am chatting to co-founder of The Running Channel and former Olympic runner, Andy Badley. Running has been a part of Andy's life since joining the cross-country team at primary school. And 30 years later, he is still running, despite having fallen out of love and then back in love with it again a couple of times. Andy's a former professional athlete as well as a qualified athletics coach. He competed in two Olympic Games over 1,500 metres, making the final in Beijing in 2008, and also finished the same year ranked number one in the world over a mile with a time of 3:49.48. But what most people prefer to talk to Andy about, and what we will probably talk about in this week's episode, is the record he set at Parkrun back in 2012 with a time of 13 minutes and 48 seconds, which stood for 11 years. In a former life, he studied aerospace engineering before taking up running professionally in his 20s. And on retiring in his career in running, he co-founded the incredible The Running Channel. I'm really looking forward to getting into this conversation. I will chat a bit more about Nick Wax, this week's sponsor, later on. But for now, let's get into the conversation with Andy Badley. Hello and welcome back to the Outside and Active podcast. And today, my special guest is Andy from The Running Channel and so much more. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's a pleasure. We were going to catch up at the National Running Show and have this conversation in person, but things were so hectic with you at the show. How was your experience and the Running Channel's experience as a whole?
Mine was bonkers. At one point, I think I was almost like hiding because we had such a lovely, constant stream of people that wanted to talk to us, either to ask us questions after we'd been on the stage or just to talk to us about the Running Channel in general. We had a bigger stand this time and the opportunity to meet people was so much more than it had ever been. But you know, after 7 or 8 hours of that solid, it's like, it's the most lovely people ever. It's very hard to continue to smile and be as like positive and effusive. So I just needed to lie down in a dark room. But it was good. And it was amazing to meet those people. Like, we had that period in the world where we couldn't see anyone in real life. And so to now have, I mean, I know it's been a few years now, but I still sort of vividly remember that. And that was when the Running Channel was growing massively. So we had this kind of virtual connection with runners around the world, but to actually like meet and see people in the real world now is so rewarding. And that's kind of the whole point of what we're doing.
Good. Well, we've got a bit of time now with thousands of people on the other side of the wall for us to have a bit of a catch up. And kicking off with a piece of advice, I do this in every episode, and it's a piece of advice left by a previous guest. And it's someone who was actually at the National Running Show as a guest, Simon Teagle, who is very soon going to be running the Cornish Coastal Path for raising money for MS, which both him and his mother have. And an incredible man, incredible challenge. And he was on recently. And his advice was very simple, but very poignant, I think. There's no tomorrow. And basically saying tomorrow isn't guaranteed. If kind of that title of the episode was, if you're going to climb Everest, do it now, because we never know what's around the corner. And I thought, especially for people in the running industry and people in the running world that kind of have these ideas of, oh, I'll do a marathon in the next couple of years, or I'll start running at some point, or I'll do this or this challenge when I get time to do it. It's actually, there's kind of no time like the present. So I thought that was quite a good piece of advice.
Yeah, that's lovely. I think I'd been putting off running my first marathon for a long, long time. And then I had to bite the bullet finally last year. So quite right. You don't know what's going to happen with family or work or just life and circumstance. So yeah, that makes really good sense to me.
The other question that I ask to everyone is very simple and vague, and it allows you to take it wherever you want. What do you love about being outside and active?
That is vague and broad, isn't it? I didn't love it the last 3 or 4 days. It's been absolutely brutal, hasn't it? I was running in sleet and gale force winds on Friday morning. Probably the worst weather I've ever
it's not been nice.
Ever experienced. No, but then the irony being that you feel that sense of achievement, right? It's sort of almost more rewarding to have battled the elements and come through it and done something when, you know, it would have been easy to just stay inside. So there's that. It was horrible whilst I was doing it, don't get me wrong. And I struggle with, if it's already raining, I don't mind getting wet on a run, but if it's already raining, going out the door can sometimes be the hard bit. But I rarely regret a run. And then it's that sense of, particularly for me, getting outside and active is doing it with other people. My enjoyment of running in particular is it's more than kind of the sum of its parts in terms of just going out with one other person. It's not just that bit, but everything about running is easier and more fun when I'm with other people. And doing that outside in like I live in the countryside, and I'm fortunate to be able to run on country roads or in the woods or whatever it might be. And that's my kind of happy place.
Because your relationship with running hasn't always been necessarily 100% positive and kind of where it is now in terms of surrounding yourself in a running community. I mean, you've kind of gone from being where you are now. You've done kind of the highest level of Olympic running, but it hasn't always been necessarily straightforward for you.
No, quite. Like So I competed in 2008 and 2012 Olympics over 1500. And even before that, my journey, it wasn't like I was the best junior or the best at my school necessarily. I just kind of kept showing up, and then other people did other sports, or you know, body shapes change or whatever, but I just loved it. I love being with some of my closest friends. Rick, who is on the Running Channel podcast with me, we were at school together, so we've known each other a long time, and we met through the cross country team at school. So that's the kind of those connections that are forged through running are really important to me. And it's those things that have kind of kept me going. The things I miss from my professional career aren't competing, and that's when I fell out of love with running. I had a lot of injuries and really struggled with my mental health because I identified myself as a runner. I didn't really identify myself as anything else at all. So when I wasn't able to run because I was injured really long term post 2012, and I moved to a new area and you start to meet new people, and that's when you introduce yourself and you're not an architect or a teacher or whatever it might be. I was a runner, but I wasn't, because I wasn't doing anything. I was just spending every day rehabbing or trying to work out what the problem was. So that was a real struggle. And then once I retired, I didn't miss competing at all. I missed being fit and really good at something, but I didn't miss the kind of nerves and the pressure of the fact that, you know, my whole year, next year or few years of funding or like livelihood was dependent on 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes once a year, and you wake up and that's the morning that you've got a cold or you don't feel great or you just mess it up in the race and the tactics don't go right, and then you've got no money for the next 12 months or that pressure. Once I got onto the start line in a race, I loved it, and I was in a race and I felt like I was in my zone, but it was all of the waiting and the kind of the build-up that I didn't miss. But this is a long-winded story of me saying, but I really missed my sort of friends and training partners. I missed that kind of consistency of training that I spent, the time I spent with them every day.
Because I guess when you're on that, like just picking up what you were saying there, once you're on the start line, that's effectively you're in control of everything from what happens there. Like, yes, there's other things that might take place, but all of the stuff before that, there's a lot that mentally and physically pressure that goes into it. I mean, you were doing 1500 meters, which is a lot of people would say is probably one of the hardest distances, because we were chatting to Steve Cram at the show and he was talking about the 1500 distance and how much he loved it. And this was on our pod show that Jamie from Runderwear was hosting, and he was saying, I couldn't think of anything worse than running that distance. It's just a nightmare. What is it about that distance that I guess you specialized in at that time, but you know, what drew you to it?
Yeah, I'm biased, so I would say it's the best distance. But it's very tactical, although it's sort of been made slightly less tactical in the last few years by Ingebrigtsen. Like, it's interesting when there's a real superstar in an event that everyone's watching, and they always run a certain way. It's sort of, I don't know whether that makes it easier or not. But prior to my period of running, there was a Hisham Al Garouj, who's still the world record holder in 1500. He always ran a certain way. Like, he'd run hard, and he often had a pacemaker from his own country in the final at an Olympics or a world champs to help him out. Ingebrigtsen does the same thing. Rhodesia used to do it in the 800 meters. You kind of, if you're in 800 meters with Rhodesia, it would go hard. I never had that luxury. I suppose, whether you can consider it a luxury. It was hard for a different reason in that it was a real lottery, and often a lot of the races I was in went super slow. Some of them went straight fast or lots of surging, and you know, you could be winning a race 15 or 20 seconds faster or slower than, you know, the previous day's race or the previous year's race. But that, I enjoyed that mental challenge, I suppose, of trusting my racing instincts once the gun went. But what I was probably not always great at was that prep. I was guilty of overthinking, I think. Like, you, in that free time before a race, you know, I remember speaking to Seb Coe and Steve Yvette at an event, and I can't remember which of them actually said it, but it rang true to me. It's like, you know, once you're in that Olympic final, nine of those guys have talked themselves out of it already. Broadly, like, don't talk yourself out of the opportunity, because the difference in training and ability and talent at that level is very, very small. And mm-hmm. So you're all pretty good. And sometimes there's a standout talent, but not always. So yeah, then it's that, I think that there's a huge mentality to sport. And I was definitely, I suffered from overthinking stuff. But once I was on the start line and you couldn't change anything anymore, because in the build up for the 10 hours before a race, you're thinking, do I need to be stretching? Do I need to be eating this? Do I need to be going for a jog? Should I go to sleep? Should I watch a film? Should I read a book? Should I do some mental visualization? Whereas once you're on the start line, you can't change anything. So you just go for it. And so I was good at that point onwards, but prior to races, I got very nervous.
This podcast is sponsored by Nick Wax, outdoor industry leaders in producing sustainable aftercare since 1977. Nickwack produce high-performance cleaning and waterproofing solutions for your outdoor clothing, footwear, and gear. Nickwack's products are made with care for the environment and help your gear last longer, saving you money and reducing waste. Find out more about their products and their brand at nickwacks.com, and you can find the link in the podcast notes. And another distance that you specialized in was the mile. And this is particularly, I guess, this year, because it's the 70th anniversary of Roger Bannister with that amazing achievement. And there aren't many people that have kind of made that achievement since. I mean, what is it that, because, correct me if I'm wrong, you've broken it in 10 different calendar years?
Yeah, I was really proud of that. Actually, I think I broke 4 minute mile in 10 successive. I run a sub 4 minute mile in 10 successive calendar years, I think, either indoors or out. And it's not run that often, so you have to kind of almost go out of your way to find those races.
Yeah, it's a similar distance, but how different is that? Because it's not just a 1500 meter race. It's kind of like that, breaking that barrier almost in time. How might you prepare for that differently to what you're preparing for a 1500 meter race at the Olympics or in a champs or that type of thing?
Yeah, often the mile races, not always actually, I did run tactical mile races as well, but more often than not, they would have had pacemakers in because everyone wants to set that up to run a fast time. The biggest difference is just where you start. It might sound like a stupid thing, but 1500 meters is designed so that you have a full straight, you start on a kind of the curve, and there's often 15 of you in the race. So it's actually quite messy and everyone's sprinting flat out, and you know, I've had my fair shares of falls and pushes and stuff. And whereas in the mile, you start 9 meters before the bend. So you've got 15 people trying to get into lane one in the space of 10 meters. And that is carnage. So that's a slightly different consideration. And then it just feels, it's only an extra 109 meters, but it feels like a slightly different test of endurance because you're so well honed to that 1500 meters that even running that extra, whatever it ends up being, I can't do the maths quickly enough, somewhere between 5 and 10%, isn't it, of distance. That it is very different. And also, just as an athlete, you're really fine-tuned to pacing and splits, so you're used to seeing your split every 100 meters or 200 meters or every lap. Actually, ironically, the best race I ever ran, I wasn't really very aware of my split. But in a mile, not only is it, you're like, you know, you're at a different place on the track every time you get to that split, you've also got that 9 meters, which throws everything out. So because the split times are still given to you at sort of slightly strange locations, you do, or when you see the boards, you obviously know where the lines are on the track. So after the first 200 meters, it's actually 209 meters. But then I loved it. I loved the mile, and actually I arguably performed weirdly better in the mile than in the 1500. My PB for the 1500 is still my split time when I won my mile, my, you know, when I ran the mile to win in Bislett, the famous kind of Oslo race, the Bislett Games, the Dream Mile, the one that in the 80s where, like, you know, talking about Steve, he set a world record there, I think, and Karen Yvette set world records there. And it's like, I spent my career almost being compared to those guys because Britain were looking for the next person to dominate that distance. They now have it in, you know, Jake Whiteman and Josh Kerr. I was trying to be that person. And what was almost frustrating, I suppose, is like, we, you know, the generation of runners just before me probably got a lot of criticism of not quite being able to live up to that. And then I ran a 3:49 mile, which at that point in the 80s would have been a world record. So like, it in the, you know, but then it got put further and further out of sight. So, you know, Steve ultimately ran 3:46. But I didn't feel like I was a million miles away from it. And the mile was the thing that was the most tangible and also connected with history. And then I was at Cambridge University as well. So I'd run on Iffley Road track quite a lot. And funnily enough, I sort of almost finished my career with a, like, my last competitive mile race was at Iffley Road before I retired. And I ran 3:59.4, so exactly the same time as Bannister ran back in 1954. So yeah, that was like quite a fitting way to finish.
Quite poetic.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, do you remember what it felt like when you first broke that 4 minutes?
I'm trying to remember. I remember, I was just trying to remember where. Yeah, I've got a champagne bottle in my living room still, an empty champagne bottle that my coach bought me when I did it. So yeah, it was Crystal Palace, 2004, and I ran 3:56, I think. So I like what went way under in my first time of going under. And yeah, just, I remember thinking, oh wow, like, because at that point I wasn't professional. I was just finishing university. And I'd only been training with my coach for that year, broadly. So the step on that I made was huge. And I didn't even believe that I could go to the Olympics or compete at that level. I was just pumped to be on the same track as these superstars. You know, Mike East and Bernard Lagat and all these guys, I think, were in that race. Alan Webb from the US. So all of these greats that were, like, on TV, I was suddenly on a televised race. I couldn't believe it.
I mean, I feel like that. I mean, that's an incredible achievement, and obviously something you're very proud of. And I feel like this conversation, this podcast, is me ticking off some more of your amazing achievements. Because one of your kind of something you mentioned in the bio on your bio on the Running Channel website is that usually people ask you about the park run record. So obviously, I'm going to ask you about the park run record because park run, as we all know, is a place for inclusive running. It's a great place for people that are getting into running to go and run with family, friends, colleagues. But you've also got the front line of park run, where there's, I imagine, is highly competitive, and people are running it for times. And you held the park run record for, was it 11 or 12 years?
11 years somehow. Years. I was helped out by COVID a little bit, I think, where they wiped it out for a couple of years so no one else could go after it. But yeah, I'll take it for sure.
But a time of 13 minutes and 58 seconds, which 13, is...
1348.
That's just me writing down the wrong number. 1348, which is obviously unbelievable. What was kind of, again, I've asked you about the lead up and the preparation for a couple of different races and distances. Now, obviously, we're stretching out by three or four times. What is that kind of, did you have that in your head of going, I'm going for this record? Because what was it before you broke it?
It was like 14 minutes flat or 14:00 something. So no one had broken 14 minutes at a park run. And I was always quite keen to, the record stood at Bushey Park. So the original, the home of Bushey, of what was the Bushey Park time trial, then became park run. And it is interesting that, to me anyway, that and I was training in the area during that period as well. So that it started as a time trial, like it was very clearly a time trial, not necessarily for the best athletes in the world, but it was, there was a lot of athletes that were based in Teddington during that period. And Craig Mottram, who I used to train with, an Aussie guy who got the bronze in the World Champs 5K in 2005, he had that record. So it was his record. And I had previously trained with him, and I wasn't training with him anymore at that point. And I was desperate to kind of go and get that record. But I didn't consider it as a world record necessarily. It was only after the fact that my kind of default was also a world record. I was just keen to go and run in this place that I trained almost every day, because I was in Bushy Park almost every day from 2005 until 2012, 2013. So it was a stretch of like park I knew really well. Not a particularly fast surface, ironically. Like it's a new course now, but when I ran it, it was grass and gravel. So it was, there was nothing, right. Not a single bit was on road. So it was about 2K of it was on grass and 2K and 3K was on gravel. But it was perfectly flat. I went after, or it was literally like 4 or 5 days after I got knocked out of the semifinals of the Olympics in 2012. And I was just annoyed about life. And my coach knew me well enough that he was like, let's go do this thing. Let's see how fast you can go. And we didn't talk about it too much, but I just really enjoyed the challenge of going and doing something that wasn't on the track and that was away from the Olympics that we've been building up to for 4 years. And the context there is that post, so 2008, I was eighth in the final in the Olympics. And I was absolutely certain that like by 2012, I'd win a medal. And just various setbacks over that in that 4 year period meant that my 2011 season got wiped out altogether. And then all of a sudden I'd gone from like, in my mind, I'm like, if I keep doing this, work really hard, I'll get a medal in 2012, you know, luck and so on allowing. And then end of 2011, I was like, I might not get in this team. I haven't posted a qualifying time. I'm really up against it, and they've made the qualifying time harder. So it was all really difficult. And so there was this release of probably of like the disappointment of not being in the final, the probability that I knew that, you know, it could have been some people in that field who did make the final who were cheating. I don't know for sure. But you know, there's always speculation about elite sport that someone might be cheating. So just in my mind, there are all of these things where you just feel a bit aggrieved. And so I set out to just show myself what I could do. And that's the important thing. You talk about parkrun, like there are people who do it as a time trial, people who do it as fast, but it's very rarely it's not a race. Parkrun's obviously not a race, but I never treated it as a race. It was always like a personal test against my own best around that course, and I knew that course inside out, so I was like really excited to do it.
So then after that, kind of leaning on the point you just said there, was it then I've set that 13:48, I'm now going to sit back and see what anyone else does, because I imagine that the word gets round, or now I'm going to try and go against myself, because I imagine you're quite a competitive person, and try and beat that time again? Or was it like, no, I've all of what you've just spoken about culminated in this particular run, and now that's, I'm going to leave that there.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't think I could go much faster. I think that at that point I was in low 13-minute shape on the track. But it was kind of born out from training previously, where I always used to do Bushy Park run in like middle or end of January, that kind of time every year in the winter, very different time. But then I got to Australia and run an actual 5K on the track a couple of times, and there was, you know, I was in similar shape. We sort of certainly thought it was like somewhere between 30 to 40 or 50 seconds slower to do it in Bushy Park than to go and do it on the track. And so my sense at the time and how I was really proud of it was like, I thought it would take something really special to go and run faster than that time on that course. Things have changed massively since then. One, there are way more park runs than there were in 2012. And there's much more understanding of which ones are quick and where you might go to run a really fast one if you wanted to run a fast one. Like that was super flat and it was beautiful conditions, but it was grass and gravel. And I never thought about it at the time, but I was running in a pair of shoes that had maybe like a 10 mil stack height, and no energy return. It was literally like super lightweight, minimal shoes. So things have changed now, which is why when it comes to athletics and the pointy end of it, I love watching the competition rather than necessarily the times now, because things have moved on.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so when that time then finally got broken, because it was only fairly recently,
2023, Andy Butcher, another Andy B, he did it up in Scotland. last year. But then, I mean, I know it's maybe we don't want to bring up points of controversy on the podcast, but now those records have been removed. So because Parkrun have taken away all of their kind of comparative data. You can still see your own individual data, so you can see all your own progress against time. But you mentioned about it being an amazing inclusive space. That was their line on that, was that they didn't want to put people off potentially from, you know, seeing course records on the bottom of event pages and things like that, because they thought that might make people worry about it being super competitive and them coming last. There's definitely some, I think that if you listen to this, there's a lot of social media and other commentary on whether that's the real reason behind it. But I don't think this is the place to go into that now.
I mean, talking about inclusive running, obviously Parkrun, again, just saying that, that is that space. But then kind of leaning into where you are now, an inclusive space to kind of, I like to think of widening the net of running. Because running isn't exclusive. We want to bring as many people into it as possible. And the Running Channel has been amazing at doing that over the past, 5 years?
Yeah, it's just over 5 years. Yeah, it's scary. I don't know where that time's gone. But it started because I was a pro runner, a former pro runner, who wanted to, I got asked a lot of questions about running, and I quite enjoyed trying to give people that same sense of enjoyment in their running that I had managed to get during, not, you know, like I said, not throughout my whole career, but when I loved it and how I love it now, that was what the Running Channel was kind of born from. And also that there are other industries that had transitioned into kind of video first media, and running hadn't, and we thought there was an opportunity to do something where we'll put videos out and see if we can build a community around that. And the scary time is you're putting videos out where, you know, 11 people see it or whatever. But you're like, well, that's 11 people that didn't know about us before. And then you're hoping that the algorithm picks it up in YouTube and then that you can start to grow through that. So that was how it started. And I wasn't on camera or presenting at all. I have no experience in that. And then we just happened to have a conversation about a particular series that, well, you know, could we make a series? And would people come back to the channel if we were making a series? So then I did some pilot stuff with a GoPro just to see if I was not completely hopeless. And then I had a day of a presenter training to take me from being a little bit more timid to then being able to try to present a little bit more. So now I am one of several presenters on the channel. And we're pretty proud of the kind of different, all sorts of, you know, diversity, but different levels in particular of runners that we represent in the different presenters. Like, yes, I have a pro background and do run quite fast. But I've spent 5 years listening to first time runners, people going for their sixth world major, and everything in between. And there's like that kind of power of shared experience that unites everybody. So ultimately what the Running Channel is a kind of, it's a place to empower runners, an inclusive kind of trusted space for inspiration, and also like unfiltered truth about running. Like that was one of the biggest things from the start, was like, we need to be the same people on camera as we are off camera. So like if you stop rolling, then it's not like, you know, we're neither divas nor not saying what we believe. To be
Hollywood
true.
Andy and in real life Andy.
yeah, a little bit. And also that running's hard. Like, we were never going to shy away from the fact that there are awful days, there are rainy, sleety days that I was talking about. There are days when you have that kind of euphoria, but actually you also get injured. You're red in the face and sweaty and don't feel very attractive sometimes. Or you're like, you know, running kit comes in all sorts of different shapes and sizes, and sometimes some stuff can make you feel fast and excited and feel good about yourself, but the converse can be true. So yeah, that's the idea. And then to do that across, it started with YouTube, but across kind of podcasts and other social platforms as well, and try and tell different stories in different places.
And like I said, the 5 years that it's been going has grown massively, just not in terms of numbers, but it's multi-platform, social media, website, YouTube, obviously being the core which started it all. How has the content developed over that time, from when you started of kind of doing these, maybe a look through the window into running to now what content is kind of what you're producing at the moment?
Oh, good question. It started as like, so we still do how-to content, like we're still here to try and educate as well. So the production value has changed massively. You know, it started with like one presenter and one camera person doing the shooting and editing, and that was the whole thing. And then that grew, and then we have a much bigger team now. And so the production value is higher. Not just for the sake of it, because actually stuff that you shoot on your phone often performs better than like super polished things anyway. So it's not kind of overproduced for the sake of it. But what I would pride ourselves on is that when we put stuff out, a lot of kind of love and attention has gone into it. We'll definitely get stuff wrong that, oh, I wish we'd edited that bit out, or we've changed this, or you spot something after the fact. But broadly speaking, we're like trying to create stuff that not only is interesting, but also like looks nice and is inspirational and can lift people up and bring them on a journey with us. And then that's the main bit that's changed, I'd say, is that the journey side of things, like the storytelling and the fact that everything's built around the different presenters, and that each presenter has a different kind of role to play on the channel. And as an example, Anna, who was the first presenter I'm talking about, who was like responsible for kind of getting off the ground, like I was working behind the scenes, but she was on camera and kind of doing everything at the very beginning. To then now be able to tell her story on the channel where she's having her first baby, and like we'll be able to do some quite nice educational content. But people are interested, because if you were interested in finding out whether or not it's okay to run whilst pregnant, then we have content that answers that question. But also people who have followed Anna's journey from like taking on the world's toughest island race in the Azores back in 2019 maybe, through to now, where it's like, this is my last race before having a baby. Or like, I think that's a really lovely story to be able to tell. And then we've got other presenters with very different experiences. So Rick, who is also, you know, he's on the podcast with me now, but he missed like almost 2 years of running. And we sometimes get weird comments where people assume he got injured by doing kind of bonkers running channel challenges, because we all did bonkers challenges. But like,
that's part of it, you have to.
Fundamentally not true. He had like a, you know, been gradually degrading with cartilage in his knee over like 20 years. And so he had a really serious injury that he might not have ever come back to running from. And then now he's actually just recently run faster for 5K than he had run ever prior to really serious knee injury. So yeah, it's kind of putting people front and center, so that, you know, I'd hope that people watch our videos and either they take something away for themselves because it's interesting and educational, but they might come back because they quite like us, hopefully. But you know, it might not be everyone, like I might not be everyone's cup of tea, but then hopefully you'd find someone else on the channel that resonates with you. Like, I'm like that person because I started running for this reason, and I really struggled with that too. And when you said that, that was exactly me. And they're the comments and the emails that we get is all of those things. We're saying, this video with that presenter really, really resonated with me because of my own experience.
I mean, I can totally vouch for that. I think the content you create across all your channels is great and amazing. And I think, I mean, you're collaborating with massive brands, with massive individuals, and that creates new content and engaging content as well. And yeah, it's exciting to see where it goes. I just quickly wanted to ask you about something that you actually touched on at the beginning, about you recently ran your first marathon, because a lot of people would go run at the Olympics, running all of his life. How can you have not run a marathon? Why was that the case? And then what was the challenge kind of doing that, I suppose?
Yeah, and that's it, just in terms of, so we obviously documented it on the running channel. So that's you can't get away from it. You decide to do something quite personal and it becomes this big project where you're like, it's very public. But the reason that was successful and that it resonated with people was because it was told that story, and it showed how hard it was for me to run a marathon. And there's this presumption that my experience of running a marathon, I think, might have been quite different too. So, oh, well, he's running the Olympics, that'd be easy for him. And it really wasn't. And that's what most of the people that have come up to me and asked about or spoken to me about was like, one, I was juggling like having three kids, and a full-time job with training for a marathon. It was very different to my professional career when I didn't have any of those things to worry about. And then two, the fact that it was like genuinely quite intimidating for me. Like, bear in mind, I raced for 3.5 minutes. So like the idea of running for 3+ hours was terrifying. And I genuinely didn't know whether I could do it. I was quite injury prone as an athlete. I had retired through injury. I had had a year of like not running at all almost through 2022 because I'd had this knee injury that kind of sidelined me. So then that was the challenge. It was like January 23, can I get my body to a place where I can run a marathon? And then the goalposts shifted along the way. When it became apparent that I probably could get my body to do it, it was then like, oh, well, I'm going to be disappointed if I don't run this time. and that was the driving force. Like, I know that plenty of people, I'd have been happy finishing, but I do think I'd have been disappointed if I didn't, you know, run at a certain pace for me. And that's what motivated me in training, because I knew what my marathon pace was supposed to be. And therefore, to do efforts at that and faster than that, started to bring it into focus. Like, okay, can I sustain this for 26 miles?
Well, you know where to go to see the documentation of that challenge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can see my longest run, which didn't go very well, actually. That wasn't ideal. And then the marathon itself was a real sort of war of attrition. But I did it, and it was one of my most proud moments. And that's the weird thing that I've come full circle with running. I never thought, if you'd asked me when I retired from running, whether I'd take any pleasure in running a marathon or in chasing times again. Like, I knew I was never going to be as fast as I was. So 1500 mile, 5K, 10K, those PBs for me are so far out of reach, I'll never be able to achieve them again. And so if you'd said to me that I would then, you know, I'd run whatever, 13 minutes for 5K or 29 minutes for 10K. If you said to me that I would find pleasure in running a 37 minute 10K or a 17 or 18 minute 5K, whatever it is, I'd have laughed, not laughed, but like I'd have been dismissive, because I'm like, well, I don't think I will find that pleasure. I'm going to have to find pleasure somewhere else. But I've almost felt like I've started again. And so weirdly, I've done things like I've changed. I used to do everything in minutes per mile and miles. Now I do everything in kilometers because it feels faster. And it feels, because if I look at the mile times that I'm running and running training now, I would have considered them very easy paces. Whereas because I didn't know what kilometer paces were, it feels faster. And so I don't compare myself to my old self in that way. And that's, I kind of have to avoid doing that. And then the marathon was totally new, so it was going to be a PB regardless. But then I have got that old bug of like seeing improvement. And therefore I'm like, okay, well, I ran this for my first marathon. Can I go 5 minutes, 10 minutes quicker the next time? Because it didn't go very well. So I could do better. And then that's the old athlete in me, I think.
I find that really intriguing, really intriguing. Just before I ask you for your piece of advice, I think just obviously kind of mentioned about at the beginning about the National Running Show. The National Road ran the first ever awards, and the Running Channel was an award winner, best running blog, podcast, social channel. That kind of leads me to the question, are there times where you can look at what you've achieved so far? And I'm sure there are fantastic plans going forward, but look back at what you've achieved so far and kind of go, wow, look at where we've come.
Yeah, that's probably my biggest job with my team, like a small team, but a passionate team about running, and is to help them to see what we've created and also the impact of what we're doing every day, the impact that has, like the lovely number of emails and comments and messages that we get, DMs and so on, saying that like we've been able to support someone. You know, we actually got one yesterday where someone said that they ran their first running event in 10 years because of their kind of engagement with the Running Channel on different platforms. And that the inspiration that they'd taken, and they felt like we were almost there, but particularly through the podcast, almost their friends that they take on runs with them, which is, there's nothing more powerful and exciting than that. Don't get me wrong, we get our fair share of abuse on social media and YouTube and all that sort of stuff, but we're a bunch of people who like running, trying to do the best we can to help people enjoy it as much as we do. So yeah, that's it's sometimes easy to just keep moving on to the next thing and not reflect on the fact that there are like these real individual people around the world who have taken the time to send us messages, and also who take the time to like watch or listen to us doing stupid stuff. That still blows my mind.
Amazing. Well, Andy, thank you so much for your time. I offered you a piece of advice at the beginning, and now it's your opportunity to leave a piece of advice to someone who will be coming onto the podcast in the future.
Yeah, it's not the world's most it's not rocket science, I suppose, my piece of advice, but it's the advice that I give to young athletes when I speak to them. And I kind of used it in an anecdote, I think, earlier on. It's just keep showing up. Like, in running, like, there are really awful days. And also there are often more talented people. But I was successful. So the story I would tell my younger athletes who I speak to is that when I was at school, I was running from the age of like 10 or 11. So I was running throughout, but just in my year 7 and year 8 at school, in my own school, there was like 15 or 20 kids that could beat me in my year, in our interform cross countries or whatever. So I wasn't even that good a runner, but I just kept showing up, and they didn't. And like I loved it. I did enough training regularly to get better. I was dedicated to showing up. And then that's ultimately like my philosophy in life now is I struggled once I retired with not having that singular purpose of like showing up every day to be better at this one thing. But it's almost just showing up for my team, my colleagues, and other people to kind of make sure that they have the support that they need, and show up when you don't feel great, but also show up when you do feel great. And then hopefully if you've got a nice team of people around you, then if you don't feel great, they lift you up. And if they don't feel great, you can lift them up.
Andy, I look forward to passing that along. Thank you so much.
Sorry, it wasn't very concise for you. Just show up. Good. There you go.
Got to summarize that in one quote. I've got that. Just keep showing up. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Outside and Active podcast as we continue along the theme of running. And thank you to Andy for coming on and chatting all about his experiences with running and setting up the running channel. Really appreciate his time. If you enjoyed this episode just as much as I had recording it, then please do share with someone who you think would enjoy it just as much as you. It massively helps to grow this podcast and to continue bringing on these amazing and inspiring guests. I'll be back next week with another episode, but until that time, enjoy the outdoors.